Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the African American Studies Center at Boston University. Speaking will be John Stauffer, Professor of English and American Literature and Language at Harvard University. Professor Stauffer's lecture is titled Douglass and Lincoln in the Age of Obama and Their Critics. We begin with an introduction by Jean Jarrett, Professor of English and Director ad interim of the African American Studies Center.
John Stauffer is Chair of the History of American Civilization and Professor of English and African American Studies at Harvard University. He's among the leading scholars of the Civil War era, anti-slavery, and interracial alliances. He is the author or editor of 7 books and more than 50 articles. His most recent book is Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, which was published in 2008. It's been a Boston Globe and Amazon.com bestseller, a History Book Club featured selection, and received the Iowa Writers Award and a Boston Book Club Award. And just when he arrived a few minutes ago, I asked him how many copies has it sold. Since Election Day, November 4th of last year, it's sold 40,000 copies, and I think that is fantastic for a scholar of literary and cultural history. His other books include The Writings of James McCune Smith, Black Intellectual and Abolitionist, published in 2006, which showcases the work of the foremost black intellectual in the 19th century. He's also published The Problem of Evil, Slavery, Freedom, and the Ambiguities of American Reform with Stephen Mintz in 2006. Meteor of War, The John Brown Story with Zoe Trod, and The Black Hearts of Men, Radical Abolitionists and the Transformation of Race, published in 2002, which is a collective biography of black and white abolitionists that won 4 major awards, including the Frederick Douglass Book Prize, the Avery Craven Book Prize, and the Lincoln Prize runner-up. John's essays have appeared in Time Magazine, Time's Literary Supplement, The New York Times, Huffington Post, Raritan, New York Sun, and 21st, the Journal of Contemporary Photography. He's appeared on national radio and television shows, including The Diane Rehm Show and Book TV with Susan Swain, and he has lectured widely throughout the United States and Europe. John's newest book, The State of Jones, was published in the summer of 2009 by Doubleday. Co-authored with Washington Post journalist Sally Jenkins, it focuses on unionism and interracial alliances in Civil War era Mississippi. By the way, John received his MA from Purdue University in 1993 and his PhD from Yale in 1999 when he began teaching at Harvard. He's received tenure in 2004. He lives in Cambridge with his wife and their 2 sons, and his lecture this evening is entitled Douglass and Lincoln in the Age of Obama and Their Critics. Please help me introduce John.
One of the dangers of trying to write a book for a general audience is that I feel, particularly over the past 3 or 6 months, is sometimes I'm walking around with a bullseye on my chest. So what I want to do today is summarize some of the central themes of Giants, the parallel lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, and along the way address some of the criticism of the book has been, fortunately, in terms of numbers, few but somewhat severe, and address it along the way. So there's 3 parts to this lecture. One, a brief overview of how the book came into being. Secondly, summarizing its central themes and try to give you a sense of what I think is new about the arguments that I make. And third, as Gene suggested in his introduction, I began writing the book, it was published on Election Day, but I began writing it around the time that Obama launched his presidential campaign. So I was on leave, and the writing process took the 21 months, writing and copywriting took the 21 months of Obama's election, a presidential campaign, and I feel as though, having steeped myself in Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln during those 21 months, I have a good understanding of what I would call the Obama phenomenon. Obama has been deeply influenced and inspired by both Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, and I want to share why I think that is. In other words, what the enduring legacies in the age of Obama, Frederick Douglass, and Lincoln are. First, how the book came into being. I've long been interested in interracial friendship and interracial alliance, and I view it as a symbol of democracy. Essentially, Americans at the time understood that. Frederick Douglass wrote extensively on friendship. He would sign his letters, "Your Friend," when he meant it. In my view, his only known work of fiction, The Heroic Slaves, is, among other things, a handbook of interracial friendship, of what whites need to do to forge friendships with blacks. And friendship throughout Western culture has been a major philosophical, political, intellectual, emotional understanding. And when I was working on my first book, The Black Hearts of Men, I realized that Frederick Douglass met with Abraham Lincoln three times in the White House. He was the first black man to advise a U.S. president, in my view, the first black to meet with the president on terms of near equality, and that Douglass and Lincoln were respective ambassadors of their races, so to speak. And that they considered each other friends, which itself constitutes an important symbol. The White House itself is an important symbol of American democracy. The next time that a black man advised a U.S. president was when Martin Luther King Jr. met with and advised Lyndon Johnson nine times. They met in the White House, by my account. So there's a long fallow period between Douglass and Lincoln and the 1960s. And initially, I had planned this book to be a chapter in a work that's still in progress on interracial friendship as a symbol of democracy, more literary but also historical book. And as I started research on it and did an essay, I quickly realized that Douglass and Lincoln and their characters threatened to overwhelm the rest of the book, and so I decided to write it as a separate book. That's essentially, at least in a professional sense, how the book came into being. There's a personal reason, which, if you're interested, I can tell you in the question and answer. I realized when I decided to do a book on Douglass and Lincoln and their parallel lives, which is the subtitle of the book, that I needed to be able to make a case for what was new, what was different about both Douglass and Lincoln. In Douglass's case, I felt it was a little easier, in part because I had written more on Douglass, felt like I knew Douglass much better. In the largest sense, I feel one of my goals in writing the book was to be able to make a case that Frederick Douglass is as important and American, is as important to American culture, American literature, and American history as Abraham Lincoln. Douglass is now finally being heralded as a canonical writer. I think both Douglass and Lincoln are among the two greatest nonfiction writers. But Douglass continues to be underappreciated from a political and historical perspective. And yet Douglass was, in many respects, I think, crucial. He pushed the Republican Party to a more progressive position. Douglass single-handedly was able to convert countless, probably hundreds of thousands, if not more, white Americans to the cause, at least of anti-slavery, perhaps abolitionism. We know that Douglass had influenced Lincoln long before they ever met. He sent every issue of the Douglass's Monthly to the White House, and he helped push Lincoln to a position of anti-slavery. As I was writing the book, I speculate about what would America have been like had Frederick Douglass not lived. In my view, it probably would have been much different. So he was indispensable. And so part of what the book seeks to do is to suggest that Douglass is as important as Lincoln. It was harder for me to make the case for Lincoln because over 10,000 books have been written on Abraham Lincoln. He's the most written about American. And yet, as I started steeping myself in the literature on Lincoln, I felt and continue to feel, particularly in light of some of the criticism I received, that Lincoln continues to be mythologized and romanticized as a figure in American history. And by that I mean especially during his presidency, I would say most historians would argue that Lincoln was virtually perfect. Every move he made, every document he signed was spot on. And that's to create a myth. Humans, by their very nature, make a lot of mistakes. They flaw deeply. And to suggest that Lincoln did not err horribly as president in every other phase of his life is, in my view, absurd. Let me give you a specific instance. Most white Americans today, and many scholars, continue to believe that Lincoln freed the slaves. Now, from Frederick Douglass's perspective, Douglass himself gave a speech about 5 months after the Emancipation Proclamation, around May of 1863, and he said in his speech, effectively, it's absurd to think that one man, regardless of who that man is, one man could free 4 million. Doesn't happen. That emancipation comes about from a multitude of reasons, foremost of which is the slaves freed themselves. They took advantage of an opportunity to flock to Union lines. Now, for the first time in their lives, friends or Union forces are 10, 20, 50 miles away, whereas most of the blacks prior to the war, to get to freedom, they had to travel thousands of miles. The chances of them surviving that ordeal were virtually nil. More than anything else, slaves freed themselves. Union soldiers and officers were also important to that. And when Douglass made this speech, he wasn't demonizing Lincoln. I mean, in fact, he said he considered the Emancipation Proclamation. He felt that it should rank with the Declaration as part of the twin births of liberty. But he essentially said that the Emancipation Proclamation is an abstract document that has no direct bearing or little direct bearing on what happens on the ground. So Douglass was very helpful for me in demythologizing or deromanticizing Lincoln. The book essentially argues that Douglass and Lincoln are the two preeminent self-made men in American history. They led parallel lives that ultimately converged in friendship. And let me address a bit of the criticism, because the criticism essentially relates to that one-line thesis. When I argue they're the two preeminent self-made men in American history, it's based primarily or more on the fact of where they started as well as how high they were able to rise. Douglass began his life as a slave, as everyone knows. He had no formal education, was prohibited from reading and writing by his masters, learned nevertheless. And he rises up. Douglass is, no one has questioned this statement, and I make it in the book, Douglass, before the age of 40, was the most famous black man in the world. He was a household name in the United States by the late 1840s. And then later on in his career, he was the first black to be nominated for the New York Secretary of State, first black to be nominated the vice president, first as a radical abolitionist in 1856, second with Victoria Woodhull in the 70s, and was the first black to receive a federal appointment that required Senate approval when he's appointed the Marshal of the District of Columbia. But even in the late 1840s, he was widely known. And in his day, Douglass was seen as, if not the greatest orator, one of the great orators in American history. Part of the Lincoln myth is the Lincoln, many scholars see Lincoln as the greatest public speaker of his day. Lincoln was good, but he paled in comparison to Douglass for a number of reasons. Lincoln had a high-pitched voice that didn't sound very good, and it didn't fit well with his 6'4 frame. Lincoln also, the three adjectives most used to characterize Lincoln were ugly, awkward, and grotesque. It's hard to be a dynamic public speaker when you're seen as ugly. Even Douglass's enemies acknowledged that he was nothing if not handsome. Majestic in his wrath, one admirer said. And Douglass had this rich baritone voice. Douglass understood that public speaking was as much about acting as it was about literally speaking and using the words. And Lincoln had horrible body movements or mannerisms or gesticulations. A number of journalists characterized Lincoln as a nutcracker because he bent his knees in the wrong movement, moves his arms. So that's one of the myths. Lincoln, to say that Lincoln was born in a log cabin is to romanticize it. It was a three-sided hut with one side exposed. And despite his flaws, I still consider Lincoln to be the greatest U.S. president. It's a commentary on the presidency, perhaps. One of the things I highlight is that Lincoln, the best way to understand Lincoln is that he's a Southerner. His closest friends were slave owners or sons and daughters of slave owners. And so his limitations from the Douglass's perspective was profound, but what Douglass came to recognize is where he started and where he rose. Now, one critic has taken me to task for suggesting that they're the two preeminent self-made men. One is pointed to Ben Franklin. One is pointed to Andrew Jackson. I mean, yes, they're self-made men, and Douglas and Lincoln emerged during the heyday of self-made men. Henry Clay coined the term in an 1832 speech. And yet Franklin and just someone like Jackson are a far cry from Lincoln and Douglas in the sense that from our perspective today, Franklin would have started his life middle class. He came from a family of candle makers. It was a respectable family. Jackson had 7-8 years of formal schooling in an academy. Stephen Douglas, another self-made man, knew Greek and Latin. Yeah, he was a self-made man. But Lincoln had less than a year of formal education. Douglas had no formal education. And one of the chief reason for Douglas and Lincoln in their capacity to rise up is that they both, as young boys, long before they ever met, essentially virtually memorized, cut their eye teeth on the same six books or authors: the Bible, Shakespeare, Lord Byron, Robert Burns, Aesop's Fables. Aesop was a slave from classical antiquity, and the Columbian Orator. There were other books, but those were the six that they shared. And they both understood as young boys the importance of using words as weapons, the power of language. They grew up in an era in which a great public speaker was analogous to being a professional athlete or a rock star, a movie star today. It was one of the only forms of public entertainment. And the other thing I should say in just defending my argument about them being preeminent self-made men is that throughout Western culture, the idea of self-making has been a prominent theme. Think of anyone familiar with Oedipus. Oedipus was, you know, in a sense, one of the great self-made men of Greece. But one of the leitmotifs of Oedipus is that self-made men come to ignoble ends. After all, here's essentially an orphan who becomes the king of Thebes, and he ends up killing his father, making love to his mother, and being banished. Defoe writes about self-made women in particular, Moll Flanders, but she's not exactly a heroic figure. She's a warning. So throughout most of history, self-made men and women were seen as warnings to society. In fact, villain, the very term villain, got its origins, in a sense, as synonymous with self-made men, someone who pretended to be someone they're not. And so self-fashioning, as Stephen Greenblatt refers to it, became prominent in Shakespeare's England. But the potential for evolving or rising up was very narrow, much as Franklin begins as a middling sort and is able to rise up to one of the preeminent founders. There's no way, in my view, Franklin ever could have become a founding father had he started where Abraham Lincoln did, much less Frederick Douglass. Another criticism, I'll just summarize these quickly before I move on, is that in describing their self-making, describing the parallel lives and their self-making, I focus on four major themes. One I've already summarized, and that is the importance of using words as weapons and the power of language. The second is that Douglass and Lincoln both grew up in brutal, vicious communities. And ironically, at the very moment they were aspiring to be intellectuals, they relied on their brawn to remake themselves. I characterize Douglass's life as a slave, as a privileged slave. I mean, after all, he was born in a border state. He was comparatively well-treated. He'd been born in Mississippi or Alabama, his chance of ever becoming free would have been virtually nil. Given how his masters treated him, particularly in the wake of his attempt to run away, suggests that his masters were either Aaron Anthony or Thomas Auld was his father. And Lincoln was poor white trash. Both of them defined a fight, in both cases a relatively dangerous, brutal fight, as a major turning point in their careers. Both of them were endowed with immense strength. Douglass was over 6'1", Lincoln was 6'4", when the average height of men was 5'7". That mattered in their worlds. And both of them married up. And the women in their lives, in my view, were indispensable to their success. Douglas has often been criticized for ignoring the role of Anna Murray in particular in his three autobiographies. It was Anna Murray's money that allowed Douglas to pass as a free black sailor, acquire the uniform so he could appear as a free black and literally acquire the train ticket to escape north. And yet Douglas, in writing his autobiography, or his three autobiographies, or narratives, in my view, was following a tradition of self-made men in literature in which he's characterizing himself as an American isolado who fights the savage and emerges triumphant. In the autobiographical tradition from Ben Franklin, through the literature, through Natty Bumppo, the male hero was an isolado figure. And Douglass's goal, in a sense, was to expand the self-made man and to encompass the self-made African-American, which is what I think he was able to do so successfully, particularly in light of the success of his book. Their relationships with people along the way are important, and I have also been fairly viciously criticized for Lincoln's relationship with Joshua Speed. Lincoln's closest friend, his most intimate friend, was Joshua Speed, a wealthy Kentuckian who, during the 1850s, became a slave trader. Lincoln and Speed slept in the same bed for 4 years. Lincoln and Speed characterized each other as their most intimate friends. And I suggest, I provide a fair amount of context and suggest that given that Lincoln slept with Speed in the same bed for 4 years, long after Lincoln could afford a place of his own, given that the tradition of romantic friendship in which it was not uncommon for two friends to express their affection not only emotionally and intellectually and spiritually, but at times carnally, physically, that it's not at all, it should not at all surprise us if Lincoln and Speed had carnal relations. And I said, we have no smoking gun. We don't know what happened. But there's also evidence that Lincoln was, according to his neighbors, had an uncontrollable libido. So I suggest that if he had an uncontrollable libido, and the most intimate letters he wrote were to Joshua Speed, it would not be at all out of the ordinary for him to have slept with Joshua. And for that, I've been pretty viciously attacked. I think the reason why is that, again, it relates to the myth of Lincoln, that if you see Lincoln as the Redeemer president, as America's Christ, then you don't want him sleeping with a man. Long before Douglas and Lincoln ever met and converge into friendship, it's safe to say they were real enemies. In fact, the closest Frederick Douglass, in my account, the closest Frederick Douglass ever comes to abandoning his hope that America can ever fulfill its national ideals and emigrating, Douglass plans to emigrate to Haiti, was in the immediate wake of Lincoln's inaugural address in 1861. And let me just frame that. Douglass's chief aim in life from the time he first started writing was immediate emancipation and racial equality. It's a fair way to kind of summarize it. Lincoln hated slavery, and Lincoln said on more than one occasion that he hated slavery as much as any abolitionist, and there's little reason to doubt that. But the problem for Douglass was his solution for ending slavery was extremely conservative, which is why I characterize Lincoln as a conservative Republican. Lincoln had a three-pronged solution to ending slavery. One, very gradual, very congenial emancipation. In fact, in his debates with Stephen Douglas, Lincoln, when pressed about when he believed the ultimate extinction of slavery should occur, said not less than 100 years. That would put the end of slavery at the minimum of 1958, barring a civil war. Lincoln also called for a colonization of freed blacks. Essentially, Lincoln could not envision American democracy with blacks living in it until 1863 at the earliest. The last roughly year and a half of his life, Lincoln was able for the first time to imagine a democracy in which blacks and whites lived together as citizens. For most of his life, he believed that American democracy was a lily white man's democracy. And third, Lincoln advocated compensation to masters for their loss of their so-called property. From Douglass's view, that is a not exactly being empathetic or understanding to the plight of the slave. And in Lincoln's inaugural address, he gives the address seeking to conciliate with Southerners. Seven slave states had already seceded. The upper South is contemplating secession. And he says two things in the inaugural address that particularly outrage Douglass. One, less so, Lincoln fervently defends the fugitive slave law, a law that in the minds of most Northern anti-slavery advocates and abolitionists, it was unconstitutional. Most progressive Republicans, from William Seward to Anne Salmon Chase on down, believed that the fugitive slave law was unconstitutional and should be repealed. Lincoln, in his first inaugural, vigorously defends it and calls for further enforcement. Second, and more onerously, Congress, roughly a week before the first inaugural, in its effort to conciliate with the South, had passed a new constitutional amendment. It was the first 13th Amendment, which most historians totally ignore. Most of you are familiar with the 13th Amendment is the amendment that abolishes slavery. The first 13th Amendment that Congress passes a week before Lincoln's inaugural was an amendment that guarantees slavery in the slave states forever. Lincoln refers to it as an inaugural address and endorses it, supports it. And yet his platform is a platform that calls for the non-extension of slavery, prohibiting its spread with the goal of ultimate extinction. Douglass reads that address and says Lincoln has totally contradicted his basic platform. There is no way with this man as president the United States will ever become free, ever achieve its national ideals. I'm out of here. I'm planning a trip to Haiti. The only reason he doesn't go is because war breaks out. South bombs Fort Sumner for 48 hours. And from that moment forward, Douglass stays because he understands that the war proper is an ideal opportunity to end slavery. Why? From that moment forward, essentially, his chief thesis is that the easiest way to win the war and preserve the Union, which was Lincoln's chief aim, was to emancipate slaves and arm them. Douglass famously said on numerous occasions in speeches that slaves are the stomach of the rebellion. Slaves are doing the dirty work for the Confederacy. They're growing the food that's feeding Confederates. They're building the roads. They're building the entrenchments. They're building the fortifications. They are enabling the Confederacy in multiple ways. They are friends of the Confederates, like it or not. If you end slavery and arm the slaves, 4 million blacks suddenly become allies and soldiers of the Union Army, or large numbers of those 4 million become allies of the Union. It's the easiest way to win the war. So Douglass understood at the very beginning of the war that in order to end slavery, the North needed to win the war. And in order to win the war, slavery needed to end. And that's a view that Lincoln very tardily, in Douglass's view, finally came around to endorsing. And in fact, in 1861 and in 1862, Douglass said on more than one occasion that Abraham Lincoln was the greatest obstacle to freedom and victory, and he characterized Lincoln as a representative American racist. Their first meeting occurs in August of 63. In the wake of the Emancipation Proclamation, the final proclamation calls for the arming of black soldiers in the North. Douglass devotes all of his efforts to arming blacks, or to recruiting blacks. He virtually, almost single-handedly, recruits the 54th Black Regiment. Two sons are among his first two recruits. And in July of 1863, he's fed up again with the Lincoln administration and quits recruiting and takes his case to Washington. He was fed up for two chief reasons. One is the black soldiers were being paid half of what white soldiers were. They were being paid as laborers. And second, they were not being promoted for service. Douglas is already one of the most famous men in America. To give you a sense of his fame, Stephen Douglas, Lincoln's nemesis in Illinois, spelled his name with two S's until 1846, until the very moment that Frederick Douglass becomes a national name. Now, I don't have a smoking gun in which Stephen Douglass writes a letter to a friend and says, I'm deleting one S from my name because I don't want to be confused with this black man, Douglass. But in 1846, he deletes one S and for the rest of his life, spells it with one S. And we know that in 1850s, in his Stephen Douglass's debates with Lincoln, Stephen was outraged when journalists did confuse him for Frederick Douglass, which they did more than once, even despite the difference in spelling. So I speculate that one reason why Stephen Douglass silently deletes one S is because Douglass's fame. He arrives in Washington on August 10th to meet with the president. He doesn't have a meeting lined up. He arrives in D.C. early in the morning. He goes to the White House. There's already a long line of whites waiting to meet the president. Douglas thinks he's going to have to wait all day, maybe two. He sends up his card, and within 2 minutes, he's called into Lincoln's office. And as he climbs the stairs, he hears one white mumble, "I see how it is, they'll let the nigger through." And when Lincoln first meets Douglas, the first thing he says is, "Hello, Mr. Douglas, I know you. It's good to finally meet you. I know you've been very critical of my tardiness. What can I do for you?" He acknowledges that he either read or he had his advisors read Douglass's writings. And Douglass brought his case to Lincoln. Lincoln essentially, you know, made an excuse for not paying black soldiers what he should have, not arming them earlier, told Douglass, you know, listen, the conservatives in the North are horrified by the idea of me putting rifles into the hands of black men and telling them to shoot whites. That's why I've been tardy. But he promised Douglass that eventually he would pay black soldiers what white soldiers were paid. They had an hour meeting. They never agreed. But at the end of that meeting, Douglass characterizes Lincoln as his friend, and Lincoln does the same. The next person that Lincoln sees that day at the White House, he says that he had met with Frederick Douglass and that he considered Frederick Douglass one of the most meritorious, if not the most meritorious men in these United States. You cannot get much higher praise than that. And Douglass told someone later that day that he considered Lincoln the king of self-made men. So in other words, part of their respect and affection stem from their appreciation for each other as self-made men. It was an important concept in American democracy at the time. The second meeting occurs a year later, and this highlights the degree to which American society had been profoundly transformed. It was August of 1864. Lincoln felt certain that he was going to lose election. He felt McClellan, the Democrats, nominated George McClellan. McClellan was running on a platform of negotiated settlement, meaning if he won, he would immediately call for peace with the Confederacy, which would leave slavery almost certainly intact. And Lincoln sends a telegraph to Rochester asking Douglass to come to Washington, D.C. for what he calls an urgent meeting. This trip is now an all-expense-paid trip by the White House. Douglass arrives in Washington, and there's a presidential carriage waiting to take him to the White House. And when Lincoln meets Douglass, he says, I need you for some important work. I think I'm going to lose the re-election to McClellan. And if I lose re-election, slavery will remain intact. He says to Douglass, according to Douglass, he asked Douglass to embark upon a John Brown scheme in which he would plan an invasion of the South with some hand-picked men, the goal of which would be to bring his thousands of blacks to Union lines. Best case scenario, Lincoln says, these blacks will form regiments, lead to a major military victory, which will change the tide of public opinion in the North and allow me to get reelected. By this point, Lincoln's basic campaign platform was one of the final 13th Amendment, was the amendment that abolished slavery. Worst case scenario, Lincoln tells Douglass, is that blacks, thousands more blacks are brought into Union lines. The South becomes a separate nation. The war ends, but at least thousands more blacks are brought to freedom. And Douglas says after this meeting, he said, I never understood the degree to which Lincoln hated slavery at this moment. And he plans this John Brown scheme. In fact, sends Lincoln this six-page, single-spaced outline of how he will use these men to bring back Union soldiers. In a sense, it's a precursor to the special forces. And ends up never coming off the ground because Sherman conquers Atlanta, begins his march to the sea, which dramatically changes the tide of Northern views toward the war and virtually ensures Lincoln's reelection. And their third meeting, and that second meeting, highlights the degree to which even Lincoln, who was by nature, I think, a conservative, Lincoln was horrified of radical revolutionary change. Lincoln, when John Brown was captured and executed for raiding the Federal Arsenal of Virginia in the hopes of inciting a massive slave rebellion and leading to freedom, Lincoln said that Brown was justly hung. Lincoln said that we agree with Brown in principle and his opposition to slavery, but Brown took up arms against the United States. He was justly hung for his actions. Now, 5 years later, Lincoln is embracing John Brown, is asking Frederick Douglass to carry out a John Brown scheme. At the same time, John Brown's body, the song, was essentially a mascot of the Union Army. John Brown, probably the most radical white man, at least in the 19th century, who was seen as a lunatic and a madman and at least a fanatic in 1859, by 1864 had been mainstreamed. Most white Americans now viewed Brown as a hero. It highlights the degree to which the war brought about a social revolution. By 64, Lincoln was also imagining a nation in which blacks and whites could live together. The third meeting occurs in the second inaugural, which also highlights the degree to which they saw themselves as friends. Douglass is invited to the second inaugural. He has the equivalent of a front row seat. In fact, Lincoln sees him as he's given the address. Douglass goes to the White House for the reception afterward. He's first turned away at the door by a policeman, says no blacks are allowed to enter. And Douglass says there must be some mistake and eventually gets in. When Lincoln sees Douglass, he's surrounded by whites in the East Room. And amid all these whites, he raises his hand and says, here comes my friend, Frederick Douglass. As Douglass approaches, he says, it's good to see you, Mr. Douglass. What did you think of my inaugural address? There is no man in these United States whose opinion I value more than yours. And Douglass responded, Mr. Lincoln, that was a sacred effort. Within a month, Lincoln had been assassinated. Had Lincoln lived, they almost certainly would have retained a friendship. In fact, Douglass invited Lincoln to tea at the soldiers' home. We know on at least one occasion, and Douglass couldn't go because he always honored his speaking commitments, and he already had a speaking commitment, so he turned down the president. And so that leads to what lessons do we learn from their friendship? And there are four that I sketch out in the book. First is, and I think it's crucial, that Douglass and Lincoln's friendship was chiefly utilitarian. Unlike, say, the romantic friendship of Speed and Lincoln, they understood that they needed each other and they could get something from each other. Douglass understood that he needed the president on his side in order for him to achieve his chief aim of ending slavery immediately and working toward racial equality. What's significant, and I think what too many historians have ignored, is the fact that Lincoln comes to understand that he needs Douglass on his side in order for him to achieve his chief aim of preserving the Union and winning the war. Because he understands that Frederick Douglass is the kind of ambassador of African Americans, and Lincoln understands that without the aid of blacks, there's no way that the Union can win the war. Second, I think their friendship highlights the degree to which political differences do not at all relate to interpersonal behavior. Lincoln and Douglas never agreed politically. Douglas was always a radical. Lincoln was always a conservative Republican. And yet they genuinely liked each other. They genuinely felt comfortable in each other's company the few times they were together. I argue it was because they shared a lot of in common in the sense that they were both self-made men and admired that. Douglas and Lincoln both had pronounced accents as young boys. Part of what the Columbian Order taught them was losing the sounds of their ignorant accents. In the introduction, Caleb Bingham says to young boys like Douglas and Lincoln, take a pebble, put it under your tongue, like Cicero taught, so that you would know the location of your tongue so you could properly enunciate the words so you could learn to speak like democratic gentlemen rather than ignorant hicks. Douglas was far more effective at losing his accent than Lincoln. They appreciated each other's self-making. There were numerous abolitionists, radical white abolitionists, that Douglas did not feel at all comfortable around because of their, particularly in Boston, because of their Brahmin elitism. Third, both Douglas and Lincoln, and their friendship hinges on the fact that they both faced a common enemy that threatened their very existence, even though they were very different. In this sense, there's been some very good scholarship highlighting the degree to which someone like King and Johnson could come together at a time in which they too faced a common enemy that threatened their very existence. And fourth, their friendship hinged, I think, in large part on their shared understanding of the very concept of self-making. I said at the outset that self-made men was coined by Henry Clay in 1832. Henry Clay was Lincoln's hero as a statesman, founder of the Whig Party. And when Clay coined the term, he coined the term in defending himself against Democrats who accused Whigs of being aristocratic. And Clay said, no, the majority of Whigs are self-made men, and he defined self-making as being inseparable from social reform. That's very different than most people understand self-making today, which is rise up to get rich, which became the common understanding of self-making beginning in the Gilded Age, beginning in Horatio Alger's Ragged Dick Tales, Rags to Riches. For Douglas and Lincoln, like many other Northerners, self-making was inseparable from social reform. In fact, one of Douglas's signature speeches became Self-Made Men, in which he emphasized that point. Self-made men seek, true self-made men, Douglas said, seek to eradicate the sins of their world. Now, most Southerners, or at least many Southerners at the same time that Douglas and Lincoln were alive, already understood self-making to rise up to get rich. In fact, in many respects, I argue, Lincoln's closest counterpart was Nathan Bedford Forrest. Nathan Bedford Forrest, like Lincoln, grew up in a border state, had no formal education, was born in a log cabin. Like Lincoln, Nathan Bedford Forrest had become famous and highly respected on the eve of the Civil War. Forrest rose up on the backs of slaves. Nathan Bedford Forrest became one of the South's greatest slave traders. He owned one of the foremost slave trading firms on the eve of the Civil War, became a Confederate cavalry general during the war, and after the war founded the Ku Klux Klan. That's a very different understanding of self-making than Douglas and Lincoln. Second characteristic of Douglas and Lincoln's understanding of self-making is that it's anti-individualistic. Douglas and Lincoln almost self-consciously opposed Tocqueville's famous understanding of individualism, in which Tocqueville said it's the belief that people can control, that Americans can control their own destiny. Douglas and Lincoln were the first to acknowledge that their destiny had as much to do with chance and circumstance as well as work and their faith in God as it did with believing they had control. In fact, both Douglas and Lincoln on more than one occasion quoted Shakespeare's Hamlet to account for their destiny, in which Shakespeare says there's a divinity that shapes our end, rough hoe though it may be. And finally, self-making for Douglas and Lincoln ultimately contradicts the very idea of slavery and racism. As Douglas well knew, and as Lincoln knew, and he said as much, slavery prohibits the idea of self-making. Slavery prohibits any kind of growth. It prohibits any kind of hope for Douglas. For Lincoln, he contrasts the idea of free labor, in which in many speeches Lincoln characterizes free labor ideology in relation to self-making, with slavery that prohibits any kind of evolution or transformation. And for Douglas and Lincoln, self-making also contradicts the idea of racism, because Douglas and Lincoln understood self-making in the sense that for them, the self was in a state of continual flux or evolution. And indeed, who Douglas and Lincoln were in any given year were different than in any subsequent year almost. Who Douglas and Lincoln were in 1835 was very different than who they were in 40, 45, 50, 55, 60, and so on. And both of them changed most dramatically during the war years. Which explains why in 1861, Douglas could say of Abraham Lincoln, "You're a representative American racist." And then 2 years later, meet him and consider himself a friend, because he understood that who Lincoln was in 63 was very different than who he was in 61. Douglas respected Lincoln in much the same way that Du Bois did, that he understood where he started from, understood his limitations, but the key point was how far he was able to come given where he started, essentially as a white Southerner. Let me end just by briefly summarizing why I think Douglas and Lincoln continue to be relevant in relation to Obama. Obama has on numerous occasions acknowledged his debt to Abraham Lincoln. He has not publicly acknowledged his debt to Frederick Douglass, even though there's very good evidence that he's deeply read Douglass. Obama paraphrases Douglass in numerous speeches, and I can give you examples of them if you'd like. I think the main reason he hasn't acknowledged publicly his debt to Frederick Douglass, because he knows if he does, his enemies will quickly latch onto the fact that Douglass was a revolutionary, close friend of John Brown, and say, there you go again, associating with another terrorist. And yet there are two, let me focus on Douglass for a second, there are two ways in which Obama has been immensely inspired by Douglass. One is, and he actually says this in Audacity of Hope, he says, from Frederick Douglass and some other black abolitionists, I've learned that power will concede nothing without a fight. And like Douglass, Obama understands that the most effective way of fighting power is to use words as weapons through the power of language. And the second main reason in which Obama has been inspired and influenced by Douglass is in the form of artistry or aesthetics. Obama, to paraphrase Frederick Douglass now, understands that true art can break down racial barriers. Obama is, like Frederick Douglass, one of the great orators of his day. Like Frederick Douglass, even his enemies acknowledge that he's nothing if not handsome. And like Frederick Douglass, even his enemies acknowledge that he is a brilliant orator and has a brilliant way with words. In fact, they tried to diffuse that in the election by saying it's only words. Yeah, he might be brilliant, but they're only words. It didn't work. Douglass would speak to crowds of thousands of whites and would convert the multitude. And I can give you numerous examples of that if you'd like. Douglass understood that when he was speaking to whites, most of his listeners believed in theory that blacks were subhuman. And yet Douglass was immensely disciplined as an orator. He understood that if he'd go on stage and become and perform his oratory, become a work of art, it would break down racial barriers and countless of whites would embrace the cause of anti-slavery after listening to Douglass. And similarly, in the Obama campaign, in the most recent presidential campaign, there were countless examples of whites who were interviewed saying, I won't vote for a black man. I can't imagine myself voting for a black man. And then they experience Obama's magic, so to speak. They hear a speech, and they essentially say, okay, you've converted me. I'll vote for you. The whole notion of the Bradley effect that everyone was so worried about was a non-event. In a sense, true art breaks down racial barriers. Like Frederick Douglass, Obama shares some other important traits. He's a son of a black and white parent. He's light-skinned. Had Obama been dark-skinned, in my view, his chances of being elected would have been virtually nil. Like Frederick Douglass, he was a privileged black man. Had Obama been raised in Alabama or Mississippi instead of at Hawaii and Indonesia, in my view, no way he would have been elected. Much like Douglass growing up in Baltimore and the Eastern Shore was privileged. From Lincoln, Obama has been inspired in two main ways. In many respects, I think, as an intellectual, Obama, in my view, unfortunately, shares more with Lincoln. He's a pragmatic by nature. He's more conservative than I personally would like to see him. But there are two chief ways in which he's been shaped by Lincoln, aside from the self-making. One is from Lincoln, he understands the importance of a political leader to reach for common understanding beyond the various social divisions, which he very self-consciously is seeking to do. And second, Obama understands from Lincoln that the proper relationship between a political leader and the body politic is one of a dialectic, that the political leader should not try to ape public opinion, should not be a slave to public opinion on the one hand, on the other hand, should not try to put a noose around the public and yank it to where it wants to go, but rather understand the broad range of public opinion and inspire the public to move where that leader has already articulated his vision based on his platform and inspire the public primarily through language, through literacy, through the power of the words. Douglas and Lincoln not only inspire Obama, I think, and I hope they continue to inspire us to bind up the nation's wounds and to complete the unfinished work and fulfill finally the ideals of freedom and equality of opportunity for all Americans. Thanks.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the African American Studies Center at Boston University. Our speaker was John Stauffer, professor of English and American Literature and Language at Harvard University. Professor Stauffer's lecture was titled Douglas and Lincoln in the Age of Obama and Their Critics. We began with an introduction by Gene Jarrett, professor of English and director ad interim of the African American Studies Center. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.